Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. What a show we have for you today. We've got a lot of fans on our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. Fans not of us, but of presidential episodes.
Of history in general.
Of history in general.
Buffs. Buffs.
And presidents in specific,
it's
right?
True. Yeah.
So we were very excited to finally get to an episode of Ridiculous History that we've been holding off for a while because we wanted to give it the attention, dare I say, the finesse that this episode deserves. Oh, also, I'm Ben.
Ben, I'm Noel, and I know you're a fan of finesse. You're a very suave individual. You're wearing sort of this dapper cap right now, very well shaven. You've got a nice lined shirt on. What do you call it? Lined? Striped? Pinstriped? What do you even call that?
I just stripes, you know,
okay.
And I get up every day and I take that fabric chalk and I draw these stripes in.
Oh.
So I really appreciate
that.
Well,
it does display a certain sense of finesse is what I'm getting at.
Speaking of a certain sense of finesse, where would we be without our super producer, Casey Pegram? But, Noel, you and I know what's different about today's episode because we can actually see
it's
each
true.
Other. We are not entering into this presidential rabbit hole alone, are we?
We are not. We are, in fact, joined by a name you might be familiar with because we've been sliding it in to our credits, a gentleman by the name of Ryan Barish, we've been crediting as a research associate.
Hello.
Hello, Ryan, alongside the likes of research associate luminaries like Christopher Hasiotis, who's been on the show for.
And Gabe Lussier.
Exactly.
Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a big deal for us for people to be able to put a voice to the name. So you can, first things first, verify that you are indeed a real person.
Correct.
Okay, and we did not make you up.
No.
Okay. I think we're set to go then.
I think
huh?
we are.
Now, Ryan, you and Noel and Casey and I started working together a few months ago because your research with us ties into, in some ways, your academic pursuits. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm a master's student in the Heritage Preservation Program at Georgia State, and a lot of the topics I've been researching have tied into topics we have explored either on trips or in classes I've taken. So it's been a good little crossover. And as you guys know, the deeper you get into these things, the odder the history can get. So
we had talked off air a number of times, and we had this meeting of the minds where we said, well, Ryan, in your studies or in your personal life, what are some historical people, events, or places that really speak to you, that really like moved you or inspired you to dig deeper and deeper and deeper? What are your rabbit hole subjects and topics? And you immediately named one just like off the top of your head, right?
Yeah, I had recently come back from Barbados where I learned quite a bit about George Washington.
That's weird, right? That's weird. You wouldn't associate George Washington with Barbados. And yet here we are talking about a trip to Barbados and we're talking about George Washington. People might be like, why?
Right, yeah. I think it's a little known fact that he had spent some time there. He's still kind of a prominent figure in their telling of modern history. And that is a little bit odd because the time that he spent there was actually very brief. But despite that, he has a whole structure dedicated to him there, which is actually the home that he stayed at while visiting George Washington. Do we want to go ahead and jump into the background or?
Yeah. Let's start with Barbados itself.
And as much as George Washington influenced Barbados, what we're also talking about today is the way Barbados influenced George Washington.
Yeah, I think that might be the bigger influence. It shows itself in who Washington became or if he was even able to become who he was.
Exactly. So before we get into that, let's get into some background of Barbados.
Just briefly, starting with the formation of Barbados, it was formed when the Atlantic crustal and Caribbean plains collided about a million years ago. Along with a volcanic eruption, coral kind of formed there. This unique feature of being a coral-based island allows the water to be pure naturally as it rises through the earth. That's something that's different than most islands in the Caribbean, but really any land in general. And it is something that ties back into rum, which is, again, a big product in Barbados. Another odd detail that differs from a lot of the American settlements is that the indigenous population had died off prior to the Europeans coming. They came from Venezuela. They were called the Amerindians. And there were two tribes, the shorter Arawaks and the taller Caribs, who ended up killing the Arawaks, but then traveling back to Venezuela and different islands in the Caribbeans. And it's not really known why, but by the time the Europeans came through, they did not see them. And going to the naming of Barbados, what is odd about it is that the Portuguese were traveling to Brazil, which many of you guys know is still a country that speaks Portuguese, was a colony of Portugal. But as they passed by, they noticed some fig trees. And these fig trees have these kind of viney, downward sloping, I guess, vines or branches that give it a beard-like appearance. So Barbados actually translates to bearded ones.
And wasn't it Pedro de Campos that actually kind of coined that?
Right. Yeah, yeah. He was the one leading the exploration to Brazil.
But he did not settle the island, right? He's the guy who said, look at these weird trees.
Yeah, he just – it was kind of a footnote in his trip. Enough of a footnote to give it a name and make an identifier as he passed it, but not something that he really saw the value in. But then the English, they came through in 1625 when Captain John Powell claimed the island on behalf of King James I, but he also didn't settle it. That would happen 2 years later when his brother, along with 80 settlers and 10 slaves, brought a ship from England down to Barbados, where they quickly cleared much of the land to make way for tobacco and cotton plantations.
Why do you think some of the early folks who discovered it didn't see the value in it? I mean, it's obviously a beautiful place. It was lush and green. If they know anything about planting and cultivation, you'd think they would have been like, aha, this is a great place to make a, you know, civilization.
Well, we have to remember that a lot of these explorers were either given some specific set of constraints or a specific destination. Mm. It seems cartoonish to us now, but it was a fairly common practice for various sailing operations to see new land and essentially say, okay, dibs, we'll come back to that 2, 5, 10 years.
If they ever did.
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think with Barbados specifically, because it wasn't settled, there was no sign of people, it might have been regarded that just wasn't an island that can sustain life properly.
Not a good sign.
Yeah. If there's nobody there beyond the excitement of conquering people, there was just no resources readily available.
That's a really good point. Do we know anything about why those native people disappeared? We know one tribe killed the other, the tall, stout ones killed the shrimpy, short ones. But is there anything in the record that indicates what happened to them? Or are there any structures remaining behind that were like indigenous structures and things like that?
You know, when I went to the National History Museum of Barbados, they were mentioning that there really was almost no sign of the natives left behind. Tools and boats and things were found in the woods, but no permanent structures. So it's possible that they were kind of commuting or using it as a midway point between Venezuela and the other islands.
Interesting.
So that makes sense with the watercraft they were using too, right? Dugouts?
Yeah, exactly.
So a dugout would be the kind of vessel that would benefit from having a couple of midway points, right? So you're not just lost out in open seas. But I want to get back to what you were saying about the original agricultural efforts by the Europeans. They made tobacco and cotton plantations, but Barbados isn't very well known for these plantations historically, right?
Correct, yeah. Tobacco specifically, a lot of people are familiar with the Cuban tobacco. That's a highly prized crop. And the idea was that it's close enough to Cuba, so possibly tobacco would take on a similar flavor. But it actually was very low quality. The soil conditions weren't the right kind to harvest tobacco. Cotton, on the other hand, still existed in a smaller form, and they actually have a very soft cotton that they're proud of, but it just doesn't really make the island a lot of money. So you start to see a transition in the 1630s when sugarcane was introduced. From nearby islands, it was brought and planted. And it turned out that the earth in Barbados was actually very, very ripe to nurture the sugarcane plants.
Almost more so than the surrounding islands even? Like it just really took off like wildfire?
Yeah. Jamaica and Barbados were the two prominent islands that were doing that. And Barbados became one of the richest places in the world at that point in the mid-1600s due to how quickly and how high quality the sugarcane was. And a little bit of a side note, because of the connection with Brazil and its proximity to Brazil, Barbados, there were actually Jewish Dutch people who were exiled from Brazil who came to Barbados, and they brought with them plans for windmills. And it was those windmills that allowed the locals to crush the sugarcane effectively and efficiently. And that was something that Jamaica didn't have. So also the means of production.
So it creates an easier path to an economy of scale.
Right. They were able to, use the wind to literally just pump it out versus hand crushing stalks of sugarcane and getting that liquid.
Yeah. And so now we've got Barbados becoming the number one player. Right, in this field, as far as sugar is concerned, because of those windmills. I have a side question there before we lose that point. Were these Jewish Dutch individuals, were they exiled like because of religious persecution?
Yeah.
Okay.
So originally they were – this actually ties into like Oliver Cromwell and the whole English religious persecution that was also happening there. At this time, Barbados was an English colony. And Cromwell used Barbados as a way to accept refugees from Brazil that were Jewish to appease the Dutch financiers as he was looking to finance war and different parts of his.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so instead of accepting them into Great Britain, he kind of had a different place he could show goodwill towards the Dutch and the Jewish population that is in the Netherlands and allow them to settle in Barbados, which is, quick side note, home to the oldest synagogue in the Eastern Hemisphere.
Amazing.
So a very religiously diverse place just kind of from its even inception, right?
Yeah. Although the congregation is quite small, I think five families still practice there. But it was the week we were there, Prince Charles and Camilla were also there, and they toured the synagogue and the various religious institutions there. There are tons of churches, one for each parish.
They heard you guys were going to be there, right?
Yeah, they came the week. They came the week we were there, but we didn't go to church with them. We went the week beforehand.
So, at this point, we've set up the context, the backdrop for Barbados, both its historical origins and its contemporary with Washington economic status. There's something fascinating here. There's a character in this story that I did not anticipate, Ryan, because we always think of these luminaries, these men and women of great important history. We always think of them kind of in an isolated way. We tend to think of them as singular entities that have, you know, historical footnotes as parents, blah, blah, blah. They might have had some kids, blah, blah, blah. But let's focus on this person. It turns out that George Washington was by no means an only child, and his sibling actually is the reason he ended up in Barbados, right?
Yeah. From his youth, he was almost I wouldn't say a black sheep of the family, but he was associated with his father's second wife, but he was still providing like monetary gifts and leaving his inheritance to his elder brother, Lawrence. So George was Lawrence's half-brother, and they kind of coexisted in Virginia. But George really didn't see himself getting out of kind of a second or third tier gentry, you know, probably would own land, but wasn't going to be anything spectacular. He finished school at 16. He was actually obsessed with this Book of Manners. So he kind of idolized the upper class, but he didn't actually know how to break into the upper class in Virginia.
Not only that, he didn't even leave Virginia. Like, he had a very myopic worldview up until this adventure that we're about to talk about.
And he didn't even meet his older brother, Lawrence, until 1738 when he was 6 years old, I think.
Yeah, they lived very separate lives, very different lives. And he looked up to his brother, but didn't quite have the same resources to really be on the same plane with his brother and run in the same circles. But yeah, once they've kind of got to know each other a little bit better, his brother Lawrence contracted a pulmonary disease that is often believed to be tuberculosis. All signs point that it was. But he asked him, well, Lawrence's wife actually asked George if he'd accompany him on a trip to get some fresher air, some clean air.
You hear that a lot with people with TB. They say, oh, you got to move to where it's a little drier, like where the climate will suit you a little bit better and you can convalesce, right?
Yeah, something you guys talk about a lot is at this point in history, there isn't a lot to do to get better, right? It's a change of scenery.
It's a wait and see approach, kind of.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like the world is your hospice. Go where it looks nice.
Yeah, so.
And also, wasn't there an issue where his wife could not accompany him because they had already lost several children and they couldn't risk the surviving child to, you know, die on a treacherous sea voyage, which happened plenty?
Yeah, I think that is a really great point, Noel. You look to kind of protect the kids that you do have, and if that means sending the parent away, the other parent, for a while, that's something that you have to do because you're trying to protect those that are healthy. And the chance of recovery with tuberculosis is very low, but the chance of infecting others is very high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, even if they did want to bring the family along, mom was like, no, I don't know if this young, you know, kind of feeble child can survive this sea voyage, you know, even if they did want to live on the island and quarantine away from dad, you know. So it was very much probably a twofold thing, right?
It's a very valid concern for sure. And we can picture a little bit of how George may have regarded his older brother because he's been, you know, largely relegated to Virginia, right? Sort of fantasizing about an aristocratic life that he feels he will never lead. He sees his older brother who had adventured abroad in England, had been in a pretty well-known school, Appleby Grammar School, getting a top-notch education. It's kind of like this mysterious figure comes in and there's something aspirational about it for George. So how would you not jump at the chance, right, to go on an adventure with this super cool dude?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to an island that's a British colony, just like the United States is at this point. And he's getting a chance to be in his brother's inner circle. I mean, that's a chance that he might not have gotten had Lawrence not fallen ill. And it's something that allows him to kind of, at least for a temporary period, experience the life that he was wishing to obtain.
And he's about 19 at this point, correct?
Yeah. He was about 19, so he was kind of in the early adulthood period of his life. And really, this is a very pivotal time. I mean, if we think about this in modern days, taking trips in your late teens, early 20s, really change your worldview, and specifically pre really any transmission of data, short of books, newspapers, that was kind of missing from George.
Maybe letters, right, that took months to arrive.
We also had his diaries, though, which is an important part of what we know about this journey.
Yeah, he was a known taker of diaries.
A known diarist.
There you go. Yeah.
I like how that sounds vaguely accusatory.
And scatological.
You, sir, are a known diarist.
So he kept this diary during this trip, which obviously to this point would be his biggest adventure. Keeping a diary makes perfect sense.
And this is our primary source too, right?
Correct. Yeah. There's still the diaries and fairly good condition for its age. There are missing pages, but that's to be expected. But what is in there gives a pretty good idea of his time on the island and what he thought about it.
How long did he end up on the island, Ryan?
So what's odd about this, because of the impact it has and how Barbados still recognizes George Washington as an important figure in its history, is he only spent 7 weeks, which is about the same length of the trip there and back. So it was kind of a 14-week trip, and only half of it was actually spent in Barbados. Huh. But he credited this trip to giving him a larger perspective on the British Empire and fresh insights on the plantation, management, agricultural productivity, slavery, wealth, and poverty. which is something he wrote in his journal when leaving Bridgetown, Barbados, the capital.
Now, let's explore that a little bit further, because you had a note about Bridgetown where you mentioned that this would have been, would this have been the largest city that George Washington had seen at this point in his young life?
Yeah, he had mostly spent time in medium-sized cities in Virginia. Barbados at this point, because of its wealth from the sugar industry, was actually a pretty bustling metropolis comparatively to the kind of semi-rural area that he'd come from in Virginia. So imagine growing up in some part of Georgia that's not Atlanta and coming to Atlanta for the first time. The size of the buildings as you travel through downtown can kind of give a similar effect of a different world.
So I think you mentioned that this sea voyage would have taken about 6 weeks. It's funny in context because apparently a flight from Washington, D.C. to Barbados now is only about 6 hours. So it would have been a real commitment to get to this place. And consequently, it's really interesting. When he was on the ship, George Washington kind of learned a lot about navigation. And he also did a lot of fishing with his brother off the side of the boat. And they actually, on November 2nd, they sighted land way earlier than they expected, because I guess the captain wasn't as crack a navigator as he thought he was, and they thought they were like 150 leagues to the east of Barbados, but then they have this very early call of land ho. And you'd mentioned those coral reefs and how what Barbados is kind of composed of, and so this side of the island that they were approaching was pretty treacherous. I mean, it would have had all of these rocks and corals and things that you would have wanted to prepare for and expect, but luckily they did land without, you know, crashing the ship.
The Success, right? The name of the ship.
That's right.
So luckily the Success was not to be an ironic name, at least at that point.
And they anchored in Carlisle Bay, and that is when he got his first look at this bustling economy, this absolutely, you know, alien world to him, right?
And Carlisle Bay is now pretty resorty, but you can tell why it was chosen as a landing point, because it's in a little concave area in the island, and it's full of sand. But all around it are the rocks and the coral that Noel described from the Atlantic side. The Atlantic side is a treacherous, rocky side, and the Caribbean Sea waves, those are softer and make for an easier landing. They kind of split the difference and went into Carlisle Bay, which is still a really prominent port for Bridgetown.
Got it.
So speaking of easy landings here, one thing that's fascinating about this is that this mode of travel, or this kind of travel, has a lot in common with travel today in unfamiliar places. The number one rule of traveling to an unfamiliar place is that things tend to go easier if you have a local connection. You know, sometimes they call them a fixer, depending on the country, but sometimes it's just a friend. And this is where George and Lawrence, but, you know, George, starts to actualize his dream of moving in these elite circles, right?
Yeah, so they were arranged to spend some time with the Clark family, Gedney or Jedney Clark. I'm not sure if you guys have input on that.
I would go with the hard G. I don't know, just commit. Let's just commit to the hard G.
We're going to go with Gedney Clark, and he was a prominent merchant in Bridgetown. He invited them to his house, but at that time—
He was family, though. He was Lawrence Washington's wife's uncle.
Right.
Yes.
Yes. And Mrs. Clark actually had smallpox. So George was a little bit skeptical about going there. He had not suffered from it, but Lawrence had, and so he was immune.
Mm-hmm.
But this illness was enough to keep the Washingtons from lodging from them as they originally intended, which actually turns out to be a benefit, because that particular house is further away from the city center of Bridgetown. And instead, the brothers stayed with James Carter, who was a relative of the Carter family that was pretty well-known back in their hometown in Virginia. So they stayed with him for the first 4 days of this trip. And then Lawrence's doctor, Dr. William Hillary, who he was recommended to go see while he was in Barbados, suggested that they go further up. As you go into the center of Barbados, it elevates, and kind of the center of the island is mountainous. Mm-hmm. And the air is drier. Obviously, it's away from the humidity of the sea. But fortunately for this story, they weren't able to find any lodging up there. And so they returned back to the city, where George, who was not stuck staying in bed, was able to go out at night. He actually took in his first theater play at this time.
Mm-hmm.
He went to dances and dinners with social elites like he'd always desired. He ate at the nicest homes in the country. He met with military leaders. This was kind of his first experience with military leaders. And something that is really unique about Barbados is it's the only British colony that was never lost. Britain never lost it due to military conquests or anything. They'd always been able to fend off invaders, the French and others.
It was heavily fortified.
Right.
And this is also, this is one of my favorite details. This is also where George Washington finds one of his favorite foods, right?
Yeah. He first tasted the pineapple during this trip.
Which is just a superior snack, I'm just going to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great fruit, and it's one that he carries with him throughout his life and is seen at almost every dinner that he hosted in the White House. He loved it as a post-dinner cleanser, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys know that. It's pretty refreshing. And it becomes something that he kind of talks about. You know, when you take a trip and you try new food for the next few months, that's all you talk about. Well, for George, that's kind of becomes his life. He kind of has a pineapple antidote in nearly all of his conversations.
So first off, I love that idea, and it's going to color the way I think about all his conversations for the rest of my life, at least. I want to go somewhere interesting with this in a bit of a circuitous fashion. So we know from his own writing that he was amazed by not just Barbados itself, but by Barbados in comparison to Virginia, right? Because Virginia was more rural, less intensely cultivated. And he talked about how there were just people everywhere. I think he said specifically everywhere was furnished with inhabitants. And while this was a good thing for him, it probably led to his medical concerns as well, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, while he was there going to these parties, he's in the early prime of his adulthood. He's taking women to the theater. He's going on dates.
Hold on. Is that a euphemism, taking someone to the theater?
It could be.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just want to be clear.
Yeah. But yeah, he's doing what most people do in their late teenage years. And during this time, he contracts smallpox despite not staying at the Clarks, which is an important note in this story for sure. Smallpox, as he contracted it on the island, where he was already in a home that had frequent doctor's visits, he had servants to wait on him. He was also in a good climate to recover from it. There wasn't anything taxing. He was...
Yeah, let's not forget, he was there in the first place with someone who was suffering from a pretty debilitating condition to help them convalesce. So this was sort of an optimal place for him to catch this and probably weather it in a way that maybe wouldn't have been the case back home, right?
Yeah, so if we think about Washington, the Revolutionary War general, he is able to recover in a bed in warm, beautiful, tropic Barbados, as opposed to the battlefields where many of his soldiers died from smallpox. So as I mentioned earlier with Lawrence, as you contract smallpox and recover, if you're successful, then you have an immunity to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually credited as a reason for George Washington's success in that war, in the Revolutionary War. But also Barbados, like I mentioned before, is important because he gets exposure to British military tactics while meeting there, which also plays a part in his war success.
Would that have been through firsthand encounters with British military officers at some of these fancy dress parties, you know?
Exactly, yeah. He was able to – the house is – his house that he stayed at and is still there is right next to one of the largest forts on the island.
Right.
And he would frequently go there for lunches and dinners and have conversations with high-up generals, which in the American military or the colonial military at the time,
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't really have access to that level of information.
Right.
And it's information of what would later become the opposing
right.
forces.
I mean, it's easy to forget. At the time, Washington is a subject of the British Empire.
Yeah.
He's that's what's up. He's definitely not a British citizen, but he's on their side technically at that point.
Well, he has no idea at this point that he's going to become such a figure in American history.
To me, that's the most fascinating part of this story.
He has no idea, just to continue, he has no idea that the United States will even be a thing. This is a very different look at this guy. And also, while we're doing a very different look, I propose we do a very honest look, because this is something, whenever we talk about the Founding Fathers, this is something that often gets skirted around or circumvented. But this guy was not a saint, right? He has actually been dogged by some rumors or allegations that he left his mark on Barbados in more than one way. He's been, people have said that he actually may have fathered some children.
Yeah. You know, when I was there, several of the people we met with, including Dr. Carl Watson, who will come up later in this podcast, would often make jokes with locals saying, "Is your last name Washington, or you look like one of the Washington kids?" it's kind of a joke that he's kind of the father of the island, and that in his 7-week period, it's possible that he may have helped conceive at least a handful of children. And it's kind of an interesting idea, because as many of you guys know, he didn't have children of his own that he claimed, at least that were shown as direct descendants of him.
None with Martha Washington, right?
Yeah, and it's often thought that he was actually sterile due to a previous bout that he had with malaria. But despite that, it's also rumored that he fathered his son with Venus, who was his half-brother, John Augustine Washington's slave. So a different half-brother. Mm-hmm. And the son's name is West Ford. And his great-great-great-granddaughter, Elise Ford Allen, has stated that Washington kept Venus as a quote from an article in the New York Times from 1999, as a personal sleep partner. And that when it was obvious she was pregnant, he no longer wanted to sleep with her.
Personal sleep partner?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So the story, oddly enough, was, well, I guess it makes sense, but was corroborated by a cousin that they only knew of each other for 5 years when the story came out. So they'd grown up completely separate lives, knowing the same story, that they were descendants of George Washington through Venus, who was, again, one of the enslaved people that John Augustine Washington kept. So it's a fascinating story, and Nicholas Wade writes about it, and the descendants of slave son contended that his father was George Washington. It's a really good New York Times article if you want to do any further reading on that.
I have to ask, Ryan, personally, how much sand do you think there is to these claims?
I think that there is a good amount of truth to these, because some of these have been backed up by DNA tests, and there's at least enough DNA to make the argument. I also think that this isn't an isolated incident for presidents, for men of this time, or for George Washington himself. So it's been often said that he and Martha had more of kind of a coexisting, co-parenting relationship rather than a physical and outwardly affectionate relationship. So it is possible that he was receiving that affection elsewhere, which kind of leads us to an interesting rumor about Alexander Hamilton.
God, I can't hear anybody even speak those words without singing it in my head.
Yeah, he's famous for that musical, right?
Yeah. He's, many of us know him because of the musical now. And he's one of the founding fathers, and he was also the first Secretary of Treasury. But there's been theories linking Alexander Hamilton to George Washington. And that link that is written about in Robert P. Watson's Affairs of the State, The Untold History of Presidential Love, Sex, and Scandal. It's a very interesting book that tries to make an argument that during George Washington's time in Barbados, Alexander Hamilton's mother, who had never been to the United States at this point, was visiting various Caribbean islands. And at some point they met up and may have had a relationship.
Hmm.
Now, it's pretty easy to debunk, because there's actually no record of her visiting Barbados specifically and no record of George Washington going elsewhere.
Yeah, but George Washington's Barbados journals had like pages ripped out. I mean, this was a fallible system of record keeping.
Yeah.
I would devil's advocate there.
So I guess we have to look at the chronology then, right?
Yeah. So with that, Washington left in December of 1751. He left Barbados to go back to Virginia. But Hamilton wasn't born until January 1755. So unless there was a long period of, gestation?
Gestation.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the one.
Then it seems not plausible.
Well, you can't let the facts get in the way of a good story,
as
right?
As my mother always says, it's true.
Yeah, and they, you know, they ended up still having a relationship, Hamilton and Washington, just not a paternal relationship.
But isn't that sort of where what got the rumor mill started here? Is that they almost treated each other in almost like a father and son kind of way?
Yeah, you know, many political rivals of Hamilton would argue that he was receiving unfair treatment from Washington and a positive unfair treatment that was kind of putting him in positions of power that they didn't feel he was qualified for. And so that could have been where the rumor really got its legs, how you can slander an opponent. We see that a lot. And
oh, yeah.
it's nothing new by any means.
It was just a different era. Political slander at that time, I mean, they went for it. I'm impressed with the propagandists of old.
Yeah.
We have to say, though, that it is amazing that only 7 weeks could have such a profound impact on George Washington. I think you're right, Ryan. I think it had the island had more of an impact upon him than he had upon the island. But you can still see you can still see traces of George Washington's time there, right? Like there's a George Washington house, right, or a complex. You went to tell us a little more about Dr. Carl Watson.
Yeah, so Dr. Carl Watson was someone we met with a couple of times. He's a local historian of great importance. He's done many great things for the island, preserved historic buildings. But this one project that he started a couple years back is something that is helping George's legacy live on in Barbados. What he's done is create a sort of dinner theater where he plays George Washington, which is odd because Carl Watson is definitely not 19, but he dresses as Washington. And you're entertained with drinks. Then you get a multi-course meal, which is accurate as you're able to get to a historic meal.
You did this?
Of the era, yes.
What are we talking here?
They call it dolphin, but it's some sort of swordfish.
Dolphin fish. It's almost like mahi-mahi, I think.
Yeah,
or something like.
Pineapple was obviously there. Red wine was the drink, and a lot of rum drinks were offered. Some sort of large kind of bean and rice dish that is still pretty common, kind of looks like black-eyed peas and rice.
Got it.
The food there is actually very similar to food of the South. There's actually a lot of ties between Barbados and Charleston, South Carolina, architecturally, culturally, and the Gullah Geechee people as well.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
If you want to know what the accent in Barbados sounds like, a person of the Gullah Geechee area of Georgia and South Carolina is going to give you a good idea of that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Fascinating.
Yeah. So the meal there, you know, it was 6 or 7 courses. His right-hand man, his enslaved person that he appeared to have a really good relationship with, was kind of running things, and they were having conversations, having jokes. He was able to flirt with his main choice.
His consort?
He picked out one of the women and had her sit next to him, and they had a nice little time.
Potential sleeping partner?
Yeah. And
sit on old George's lap here. And that's a little creepy, you know?
Yeah.
And she just played into it? This is literally someone that was a tourist that was there for the dinner?
Yeah. He had his choice of 8. He chose one.
All right.
And they did it. But the important thing about it is that it's a way to raise money for the property and to keep the property in good shape. Something that many island nations have issues with is preserving buildings in the conditions, the humidity, the salt. All of that is really unforgiving and requires a lot of money. So I think that's something really important that Dr. Carl Watson is doing with that program.
And just to double back, that is your kind of primary focus in your studies is preservation of these kinds of spots.
Yeah, this trip wasn't focused on the preservation aspect, but it is something that's always important when we're looking at history and how to tell accurate history is being able to preserve structures that can help understand what the past was like. They do a great job there with historical furniture in the building. they've raised the ceilings, but they've marked how low the ceilings were. Because they were like 6.5 foot ceilings at the time.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, there are many people who are around 6'5 and taller. So they've accommodated. And it's something they've done a really good job in the past decade in Barbados is making these historic structures accessible to all people, including those who are disabled or need assistance with accessing different parts of these buildings. Because obviously a house built in the 1600s is not going to have an elevator or ramps for people in wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. But Barbados is taking great pride in making their buildings accessible. So I think it's really important in their preservation work.
Ryan, thank you so much for showing us this, I'll say it, this largely unknown episode of George Washington's life. And I'm fascinated with this, and I have to ask, I understand if you can't tell me due to some sort of proprietary NDA or something, but what are you working on now? What are your studies focusing on?
I mean, right now I'm kind of wrapping up my last couple of classes in the program, actually working on archival work. Museum studies are kind of the two big places I'm doing. I'm studying how visitor interactions work when you're in a museum and ways to maximize content for all types of visitors, not just the highly educated or the older crowd, but we want to have these same exhibits give information to both young and old, educated, uneducated, and just making history more accessible to all sorts of people. And my primary focus in history always has been underserved populations and making sure that they're credited with their part in history. And that's where I think while this story about George Washington and Barbados is extremely fascinating and important, I think there are many things in Barbados that warrant their own special consideration. It's an island full of history. It's not just the birthplace of Rihanna, although they do have a really great monument to her, which is her grandma's house that they basically enshrined, and it's not a house. And there's a video board in front of it that just has pictures of Rihanna. It's an interesting city for sure. They're proud of their goddess there.
They're proud of their goddess there, indeed. Also, the home of grapefruit, right?
Yeah, there is a Welchman Hall Gully, which is a kind of now a nature preserve, but was once a plantation of a prominent soldier there. He was really interested in diversifying the plant life in Barbados. He combined the sweet orange and shaddock plant to create what at the time was called the forbidden fruit. But later, the name was changed to the less interesting grapefruit. Grapefruit because of how it grows in clusters, but I kind of also don't really see that. I don't really see how they grow much different than oranges, but apparently grapefruits grow closer together than oranges do.
I will say this, though. I did not know until talking about this with you what a shaddock was, and it looks like a pear, but it's a citrus fruit, and it breaks open, and it's got like segments. It looks like a lime inside. So that's really interesting to hybridize those. And now you don't really hear about shaddocks anymore.
Yeah.
Also called a pomelo.
And I think grapefruits are just terrible.
I get harassed for this all the time. I can't stand pulp. I like orange juice. It has to be basically water. I can't do any type of pulp. So citrus fruits, I can bite on them, but then I'm out. Mm-hmm. Grapefruits are a little too bitter for me. But the monkeys at Welchman Hall Gully, they love them. There's one type of monkey on the island, and it sits in the gully is one of its prominent homes and eats the grapefruits, throws the peels around, cohabitates with chickens. It's a pretty interesting place. Of not necessarily historical significance, short of the grapefruit, but the diversity of wildlife that is there is mind-blowing. It's a really good example of a dense rainforest that's easily accessible.
And we've hinted at this too already with Washington and his obsession with the stuff, but Barbados, huge for rum distillation, which was a byproduct of all of that sugar cane that they were able to make and crush up so efficiently using those Dutch windmills, right? And the oldest distillery in the world, I believe, was in Mount Gay in Bridgetown, Barbados, right?
The oldest rum distillery?
That's what I meant, right? Yes. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, exactly. The oldest rum distillery.
Yeah, and this rum distillery dates back to 1703, and that's based on some land deeds that are still kept by the city of Bridgetown. The interesting thing about sugarcane production and the formation of molasses is that a sugarcane has almost no waste product. Even to this day, when they're creating it in Barbados, even the runoff of the molasses that's used to make the rum is then used for fertilizer. So it's almost 100% used product, which is pretty rare and does a lot for the island. It's still a part of its economy, obviously not as it once was, but the rum industry is huge. And Mount Gay is sold here in the States. It's a pretty nice rum, and we got to tour the facility there. I had almost no experience with rum, and now I know the differences, and there are some really strong ones that I can't imagine what you drink them with. But for whatever reason, they do exist. There are some rums so potent there that they have to cut them because they're about 160 proof.
Wow.
Rums that they're having to cut down to get to like 125.
Yeah, that's a little more reasonable.
So if you find yourself hurtled backward in time and you are speaking with George Washington and you really want to get on his good side, you show up with a pineapple and a handle of rum from Mount Gay.
Yeah. In fact, just like the pineapple, he would often reject Jamaican rum at his home if it showed up and ask that they go get him some Mount Gay or other Bajan rums. And Bajan is just a kind of a short local word for Barbadian, but Bajan is what they say more commonly. So he preferred the Bajan rum to the Jamaican rum every time until his death. It was always well-stocked at his homes.
So there you have it, folks. Ryan Barish, thank you so much for helping us, A, prove you're a real person, and B, teaching us so much about not just George Washington, but Barbados, grapefruits,
historic preservation, all of this stuff. The amazing program at Georgia State University right here in Atlanta that you're a part of.
Yeah. Side note, by the way, I don't know if we can say this. Ryan, your professor has been in the studio evaluating this the whole time. What do you think, Doc? Thumbs up? Thumbs down? That's a thumbs up.
Got a solid thumbs up.
There we go. He knows I'm a real person now, too.
So, Ryan, if people want to learn more about you and your work, where can they follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at the handle is just Barish, B-E-R-E-S-C-H, which is my last name. Pretty easy, but that's probably going to be the best place to keep up with me. You can also follow Georgia State University's Heritage Preservation Program on Instagram at GSU_MHP.
All right, so that is Barish on Twitter. Thank you so much for tuning in, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thanks to Casey Pegram, our super producer. Thanks to Gabe Luzier. And hey, Ryan, we've said it multiple times now, but you're part of the show, so we always say thank you to you at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's not weird that we're saying it while you're here.
No, right? Of course not. Okay. No. So big thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis. There is always a Christopher-shaped hole in my heart that I think is going to get filled, maybe not in my heart, Ben, but in yours next week when he joins you for a couple of episodes, right?
That's true. Spoiler alert. Yes, we have some surprises in store. Thanks, of course, to you folks for listening. The conversation doesn't stop just when the recording ends. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. Hang out with our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners, on our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. We're some version of Ridiculous History all over the internet. We also have personal Instagrams that you can find us on if you want to follow our own non-Ridiculous History adventures.
Yeah, I am at HowNowNoelBrown on Instagram.
And I am at Ben Bullen on Instagram. I am at Ben Bullen HSW on Twitter. Let's see, what else? You want to go get some rum?
Oh, big time. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.